Chapter 15. Right Concentration. The practice of right concentration, Samyak Samadhi, is to cultivate a mind that is one-pointed. The Chinese character for concentration means, literally, maintaining evenness, neither too high nor too low, neither too excited nor too dull. Another Chinese term sometimes used for concentration means the abode of true mind. There are two kinds of concentration, active and selective. In active concentration, the mind dwells on whatever is happening in the present moment, even as it changes. This poem by a Buddhist monk, Vietnamese Dhyana master Huang Hai, Ocean of Fragrance, describes active concentration. The wind whistles in the bamboo, and the bamboo dances. When the wind stops, the bamboo grows still. The wind comes, and the bamboo welcomes it. The wind goes, and the bamboo lets it go. The poem continues, "A silver bird flies over the autumn lake. When it has passed, the lake's surface does not try to hold on to the image of the bird. As the bird flies over the lake, its reflection is lucid. After it is gone, the lake reflects the clouds and the sky just as clearly. When we practice active concentration, we welcome whatever comes along. We don't think about or long for anything else. We just dwell in the present moment with all our being. Whatever comes, comes. When the object of our concentration has passed, our mind remains clear, like a calm lake. When we practice selective concentration, we choose one object and hold on to it. During sitting and walking meditation, whether alone or with others, we practice. We know that the sky and the birds are there, but our attention is focused on our object. If the object of our concentration is a math problem, we don't watch TV or talk on the phone. We abandon everything else and focus on the object. When we are driving, the lives of the passengers in our car depend on our concentration. We don't use concentration to run away from our suffering. We concentrate to make ourselves deeply present. When we walk, stand, or sit in concentration, people can see our stability and stillness. Living each moment deeply, sustained concentration comes naturally, and that, in turn, gives rise to insight. Right concentration leads to happiness, and it also leads to right action. The higher our degree of concentration, the greater the quality of our life. Vietnamese girls are often told by their mothers that if they concentrate, they will be more beautiful. This is the kind of beauty that comes from dwelling deeply in the present moment. When a young lady moves inattentively, she does not look as fresh or at ease. Her mother may not use these words, but she is encouraging her daughter to practice right concentration. It is a pity she does not encourage her son to do the same. Everyone needs concentration. There are 9 levels of meditative concentration. The first 4 are the 4 dhyanas. These are concentrations on the form realm. The next 5 levels belong to the formless realm. When practicing the first dhyana, you still think. At the other 8 levels, thinking gives way to other energies. Formless concentrations are also practiced in other traditions, but when they are practiced outside of Buddhism, it is generally to escape from suffering, rather than to realize the liberation that comes with insight into our suffering. When you use concentration to run away from yourself or your situation, it is wrong concentration. Sometimes we need to escape our problems for relief, but at some time we have to return to face them. Worldly concentration seeks to escape. Supramundane concentration aims at complete liberation. To practice samadhi is to live deeply each moment that is given us to live. Samadhi means concentration. In order to be concentrated, we should be mindful, fully present, and aware of what is going on. Mindfulness brings about concentration. When you are deeply concentrated, you are absorbed in the moment. You become the moment. That is why samadhi is sometimes translated as absorption. Right mindfulness and right concentration lift us above the realms of sensual pleasures and craving, and we find ourselves lighter and happier. Our world is no longer gross and heavy, the realm of desires, karma dhatu. It is the realm of fine materiality, the realm of form, rupa dhatu. In the form realm, there are four levels of dhyana: mindfulness, concentration, joy, happiness, peace, and equanimity continue to grow through these four levels. After the fourth dhyana, the practitioner enters a deeper experience of concentration, the four formless dhyanas, where he or she can see deeply into reality. Here, sensual desire and materiality reveal their illusory nature and are no longer obstacles. You begin to see the impermanent, non-self, and interbeing nature of the phenomenal world. Earth, water, air, fire, space, time, nothingness, and perceptions inter are. Nothing can be by itself alone. The object of the fifth level of concentration is limitless space. When we begin to practice this concentration, everything seems to be space. But as we practice more deeply, we see that space is composed of and exists only in non-space elements, like earth, water, air, fire, and consciousness. Because space is only one of the six elements that make up all material things, we know space does not have a separate, independent existence. According to the teachings of the Buddha, nothing has a separate self. So space and everything else inter are. Space inter is with the other five elements. The object of the sixth level of concentration is limitless consciousness. At first, we see only consciousness, but then we see that consciousness is also earth, water, air, fire, and space. What is true of space is also true of consciousness. The object of the seventh level of concentration is nothingness. With normal perception, we see flowers, fruit, teapots, and tables, and we think they exist separately of one another. But when we look more deeply, we see that the fruit is in the flower, and that the flower, the cloud, and the earth are in the fruit. We go beyond outward appearances or signs and come to signlessness. At first, we think that the members of our family are separate from one another, but afterwards, we see that they contain each other. You are the way you are because I am the way I am. We see the intimate connection between people, and we go beyond signs. We used to think that the universe contains millions of separate entities. Now we understand the non-existence of signs. The eighth level of concentration is that of neither perception nor non-perception. We recognize that everything is produced by our perceptions, which are, at least in part, erroneous. Therefore, we see that we cannot rely on our old way of perceiving, and we want to be in direct touch with reality. We cannot stop perceiving altogether, but at least now we know that perception is perception of a sign. Since we no longer believe in the reality of signs, our perception becomes wisdom. We go beyond signs, no perception, but we do not become perceptionless, no non-perception. The ninth level of concentration is called cessation. Cessation here means the cessation of ignorance in our feelings and perceptions, not the cessation of feelings and perceptions. From this concentration is born insight. The poet Wen Zhu said, "As soon as we see with our eyes and hear with our ears, we open ourselves to suffering." We long to be in a state of concentration where we cannot see or hear anything, in a world where there is no perception. We wish to become a pine tree with the wind singing in our branches, because we believe that a pine tree does not suffer. The search for a place of non-suffering is natural. In the world of non-perception, the seventh, manas, and the eighth, alaya, consciousnesses, continue to function as usual, and our ignorance and internal formations remain intact in our store consciousness, and they manifest in the seventh consciousness. The seventh consciousness is the energy of delusion that creates the belief in a self and distinguishes self from other. Since the non-perception concentration does not transform our habit energies, when people emerge from that concentration, their suffering is intact. But when the meditator reaches the ninth level of concentration, the stage of arhat, manas is transformed, and the internal formations in the store consciousness are purified. The greatest internal formation is ignorance of the reality of impermanence and non-self. This ignorance gives rise to greed, hatred, confusion, pride, doubt, and views. Together, these afflictions produce a war of consciousness called manas, which always discriminates self from other. When someone practices well, the ninth level of concentration shines light on the reality of things and transforms ignorance. The seeds that used to cause you to be caught in self and non-self are transformed. Alaya is freed from the grip of manas, and manas no longer has the function of making a self. Manas becomes the wisdom of equality that can see the interbeing and interpenetrating nature of things. It can see that others' lives are as precious as our own, because there is no longer discrimination between self and other. When manas loses its grip on store consciousness becomes the wisdom of the great mirror that reflects everything in the universe. When the sixth consciousness, manovijnana, is transformed, it is called the wisdom of wonderful observation. Mind consciousness continues to observe phenomena after it has been transformed into wisdom, but it observes them in a different way, because mind consciousness is aware of the interbeing nature of all that it observes, seeing the one in the many, all the manifestations of birth and death, coming and going, and so on, without being caught in ignorance. The first five consciousnesses become the wisdom of wonderful realization. Our eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and body that previously caused us to suffer become miracles that bring us to the garden of suchness. Thus, the transformation of all levels of consciousness is realized as four wisdoms. Our wrong consciousness and wrong perceptions are transformed thanks to the practice. At the ninth level of concentration, all eight consciousnesses are functioning. Perception and feeling are still there, but they are different from before, because they are free from ignorance. The Buddha taught many concentration practices. To practice the concentration on impermanence, every time you look at your beloved, see him as impermanent, and do your best to make him happy today. If you think he is permanent, you may believe that he will never improve. The insight into impermanence keeps you from getting caught in the suffering of craving, attachment, and despair. See and listen to everything with this insight. To practice the concentration on non-self, touch the nature of interbeing in everything you contact. This will bring you a lot of peace and joy and prevent you from suffering. The practice of the concentration on nirvana helps you to touch the ultimate dimension of reality and establish yourself in the realms of no birth and no death. The concentrations on impermanence, non-self, and nirvana are enough for us to practice our whole lives. In fact, the three are one. If you touch the nature of impermanence deeply, you touch the nature of non-self, interbeing, and nirvana. One concentration contains all concentrations. You don't need to do everything. In Mahayana Buddhism, there are hundreds of other concentrations, such as the Sharangama Samadhi, the concentration of the heroic march, the Siddharma Pundarika Samadhi, and the Avatamsaka Samadhi. Each is wonderful and important. According to the Lotus Sutra, we have to live in the historical and ultimate dimensions of reality at the same time. We have to live deeply our life as a wave so we can touch the substance of water in us. We walk, look, breathe, and eat in a way that we touch the absolute dimension of reality. We transcend birth and death and the fears of being and non-being, one and many. The Buddha is not found only on Great Hirakuta, the Vulture Peak. If you were to hear on the radio that the Buddha is going to reappear on Great Hirakuta Mountain, and the public is invited to join him for walking meditation, all the seats on all the airplanes to India would be booked, and you might feel frustrated because you want to go also. Even if you were lucky enough to get a seat on that plane, it still might not be possible for you to enjoy practicing walking meditation with the Buddha. There would be so many people, most of whom don't know how to practice breathing in and out and dwelling in the present moment while walking. What is the use of going there? Look deeply at your intention. Do you want to fly halfway around the world so that later you can say you were with the Buddha? Many people want to do just that. They arrive at a place of pilgrimage, unable to be in the here and the now. After a few minutes of seeing the place, they rush to the next place. They take pictures to prove they were there, and they are eager to return home to show their friends. I was there. I have proof. That is me standing beside the Buddha. That would be the desire of many of the people who would go there. They are not able to walk with the Buddha. They are not able to be in the here and the now. They only want to say, I was there, and this is me standing beside the Buddha. But it is not true. They were not there, and that is not the Buddha. Being there is a concept, and the Buddha that you see is a mere appearance. You cannot photograph the real Buddha, even if you have a very expensive camera. If you don't have the opportunity to fly to India, please practice walking at home, and you can really hold the hand of the Buddha while you walk. Just walk in peace and happiness, and the Buddha is there with you. The one who flies to India and returns with his photo taken with the Buddha has not seen the real Buddha. You have the reality. He has only a sign. Don't run around looking for photo opportunities. Touch the real Buddha. He is available. Take his hand and practice walking meditation. When you can touch the ultimate dimension, you walk with the Buddha. The wave does not need to die to become water. She is already water. This is the concentration of the Lotus Sutra. Live every moment of your life deeply. And while walking, eating, drinking, and looking at the morning star, you touch the ultimate dimension. Chapter 16. Right Livelihood. To practice right livelihood, samyag ajiva, you have to find a way to earn your living without transgressing your ideals of love and compassion. The way you support yourself can be an expression of your deepest self, or it can be a source of suffering for you and others. The sutras usually define right livelihood as earning a living without needing to transgress any of the five mindfulness trainings: not dealing in arms, in the slave trade, the meat trade, the sale of alcohol, drugs, or poisons, or making prophecies or telling fortunes. Monks and nuns must be careful not to make unreasonable demands on the laity for the four requisites of medicine, food, clothes, and lodging, and not to live with material requisites in excess of immediate needs. Bringing awareness to every moment, we try to have a vocation that is beneficial to humans, animals, plants, and the earth, or at least minimally harmful. We live in a society in which jobs are sometimes hard to find, but if it happens that our work involves harming life, we should try to find another job. Our vocation can nourish our understanding and compassion, or erode them. We should be awake to the consequences, far and near, of the way we earn our living. So many modern industries are harmful to humans and nature, even food production. Chemical pesticides and fertilizers can cause a lot of harm to the environment. Practicing right livelihood is difficult for farmers. If they do not use chemicals, it may be difficult for them to compete commercially. This is just one example. When you practice your profession or trade, observe the five mindfulness trainings. A job that involves killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, lying, or selling drugs or alcohol is not right livelihood. If your company pollutes the rivers or the air, working there is not right livelihood. Making weapons or profiting from others' superstitions is also not right livelihood. People have superstitions, such as believing that their fate is sealed in the stars or in the palms of their hands. No one can be sure what will occur in the future. By practicing mindfulness, we can change the destiny astrologers have predicted for us. Moreover, prophecies can be self-fulfilling. Composing or performing works of art can also be livelihood. A composer, writer, painter, or performer has an effect on the collective consciousness. Any work of art is, to a large extent, a product of the collective consciousness. Therefore, the individual artist needs to practice mindfulness so that his or her work of art helps those who touch it practice right attention. A young man wanted to learn how to draw lotus flowers, so he went to a master to apprentice with him. The master took him to a lotus pond and invited him to sit there. The young man saw flowers bloom when the sun was high, and he watched them return into buds when night fell. The next morning, he did the same. When one lotus flower wilted and its petals fell into the water, he just looked at the stalk, the stamen, and the rest of the flower, and then moved on to another lotus. He did that for 10 days. On the 11th day, the master asked him, "Are you ready?" And he replied, "I will try." The master gave him a brush, and although the young man's style was childlike, the lotus he drew was beautiful. He had become the lotus, and the painting came forth from him. You could see his naivete concerning technique, but deep beauty was there. Right livelihood is not just a personal matter. It is our collective karma. Suppose I am a school teacher, and I believe that nurturing love and understanding in children is a beautiful occupation. I would object if someone were to ask me to stop teaching and become, for example, a butcher. But when I meditate on the interrelatedness of things, I see that the butcher is not the only person responsible for killing animals. We may think the butcher's livelihood is wrong and ours is right, but if we didn't eat meat, he would not have to kill. Right livelihood is a collective matter. The livelihood of each person affects everyone else. The butcher's children might benefit from my teaching, while my children, because they eat meat, share some responsibility for the butcher's livelihood. Suppose a farmer who sells his cattle as meat wants to receive the five mindfulness trainings. He wants to know if he can, in light of the first training to protect life. He feels that he gives his cattle the best conditions for their well-being. He even operates his own slaughterhouse so that there is no unnecessary cruelty inflicted on the animals when he puts an end to their lives. He inherited his farm from his father, and he has a family to support. This is a dilemma. What should he do? His intentions are good, but he has inherited his farm and his habit energies from his ancestors. Every time a cow is slaughtered, it leaves an impression on his consciousness, which will come back to him in dreams, during meditation, or at the moment of death. It is right livelihood to look after his cows so well while they are alive. He has the wish to be kind to his cows, and he also wants the security of regular income for himself and his family. He should continue to look deeply and practice mindfulness with his local sangha. As his insight deepens, the way out of the situation where he finds himself killing to make a living will present itself. Everything we do contributes to our effort to practice right livelihood. It is more than just the way we earn our paycheck. we cannot succeed at having a right livelihood 100%, but we can resolve to go in the direction of compassion and reducing suffering. And we can resolve to help create a society in which there is more right livelihood and less wrong livelihood. Millions of people, for example, make their living in the arms industry, helping directly or indirectly to manufacture conventional and nuclear weapons. The U.S., Russia, France, Britain, China, and Germany are the primary suppliers of these weapons. Weapons are then sold to third world countries, where the people do not need guns, they need food. To manufacture or sell weapons is not right livelihood. But the responsibility for this situation lies with all of us, politicians, economists, and consumers. We have not yet organized a compelling national debate on this problem. We have to discuss this further, and we have to keep creating new jobs so that no one has to live on the profits from weapons manufacture. If you are able to work in a profession that helps realize your ideal of compassion, be grateful. And please try to help create proper jobs for others by living mindfully, simply, and sanely. Use all of your energy to try to improve the situation. To practice right livelihood means to practice right mindfulness. Every time the telephone rings, hear it as a bell of mindfulness. Stop what you are doing, breathe in and out consciously, and then proceed to the telephone. The way you answer the phone will embody right livelihood. We need to discuss among ourselves how to practice mindfulness in the workplace, how to practice right livelihood. Do we breathe when we hear the telephone ringing and before we pick up the phone to make a call? Do we smile while we take care of others? Do we walk mindfully from meeting to meeting? Do we practice right speech? Do we practice deep and total relaxation after hours of hard work? Do we live in ways that encourage everyone to be peaceful and happy and to have a job that is in the direction of peace and happiness? These are very practical and important questions. To work in a way that encourages this kind of thinking and acting, in a way that encourages our ideal of compassion, is to practice right livelihood. If someone has a profession that causes living beings to suffer and oppresses others, it will infect their own consciousness, just as when we pollute the air that we ourselves have to breathe. Many people get rich by means of wrong livelihood. Then they go to their temple or church and make donations. These donations come from feelings of fear and guilt, rather than the wish to bring happiness to others and relieve others of suffering. When a temple or church receives large donations, those responsible for receiving the funds must understand this. They should do their best to help the donor transform by showing him or her a way out of that wrong livelihood. Such persons need, more than anything, the teachings of the Buddha. As we study and practice the Noble Eightfold Path, we see that each element of the path is contained within all the other seven elements. We also see that each element of the path contains the noble truths of suffering, the making of suffering, and the ending of suffering. Practicing the first noble truth, we recognize our suffering and call it by its name: depression, anxiety, fear, or insecurity. Then we look directly into that suffering to discover its basis. And that is practicing the second noble truth. Practices contain the first two elements of the Noble Eightfold Path, namely right view and right thinking. All of us have a tendency to run away from suffering. But now, with the practice of the Noble Eightfold Path, we have the courage to face our suffering directly. We use right mindfulness and right concentration to look courageously at our suffering. The looking deeply that shows us clearly the basis of our suffering is right view. Right view will not show one reason for our suffering, but layers upon layers of causes and conditions, seeds we have inherited from our parents, grandparents, and ancestors, seeds in us that have been watered by our friends and the economic and political situations of our country, and so many other causes and conditions. Now the time has come to do something to lessen our suffering. Once we know what is feeding our suffering, we find a way to cease ingesting that nutriment, whether it is edible food, the food of sense impression, the food we receive from our intentions, or the food from our consciousness. We do this by practicing right speech, right action, and right livelihood, remembering that right speech is also listening deeply. To practice these three aspects, we take the mindfulness trainings as our guide. Practicing according to the mindfulness trainings, we see that when we speak, act, or earn our living, we do it with right mindfulness. Right mindfulness lets us know when we say something that is not right speech or do something that is not right action. Once right mindfulness is practiced, along with right diligence, right concentration will follow easily and give rise to insight or right view. In fact, it is not possible to practice one element of the Noble Eightfold Path without practicing all seven other elements. This is the nature of interbeing, and it is true for all of the teachings offered by the Buddha.